Thanks for listening to one of our Sunday messages at Crossroads Bible Church. We gather on Sunday mornings at 9:15 and 10:45 a.m. To find out more about our church or to connect with any of our ministries, visit our website at crossroadsbible.org. We hope you enjoy the message and pray it encourages you as you follow Jesus.
We are in a series called Family Rhythms, the study in the Beatitudes. And why we're calling it Family Rhythms is because each week we're going to look at a different beatitude. But it's really important to know that as we look at a different beatitude each week, we're not just talking about how we can be better Christians or how we can act a certain way and make God happy with us. We call these family rhythms because what Jesus did was he came and said, I am starting a new family. You can be in it. And then he said, this is what it looked like. And so these eight beatitudes we're going to be in over the next 7 weeks reflect the rhythms of God's family. So each week we're going to share a different rhythm from some families in our communities. And last week I talked about how my family ate a meal together every single night. And because we were riding hours, we joined for dinner. And this week I was talking to my wife. And her grandmother was a woman named Ronnie. And Ronnie was very outgoing and she had a gift of hospitality. And she used to throw these Cosmo parties. If you don't know what a Cosmo is, it's a drink. And she would throw these parties, I guess, all through her life. And then I met her when she was living in a senior care facility. And she'd throw these Cosmo parties for the women on her floor, you know? She'd just open her door and be like, who wants a Cosmo? And I'd show up as the only guy under 50, you know? I'd be like, me. I love my in-laws, man. And she would throw these parties, and through throwing these parties, people got to know who she was. And so every year on Mother's Day now, when we get together with my wife's side of the family, we drink a Cosmo from the recipe card that's on my mother-in-law's bookshelf, and we remember her mother. It's really beautiful. And why we say things like that is because what rhythms do fundamentally is they paint a picture of who we want to become. We take the best of us, and we repeat it. And we say, this is the family we're creating together. And so when Jesus says in Matthew 5, blessed are, what he's saying is, this is the family we're creating together. These are our rhythms. And last week we looked at blessed are the poor in spirit, this simple idea that Jesus says, in order to be a part of the family, you just got to know that you need to be a part of the family. And we looked at it and said, we can't save ourselves. God does that for us. And this week's a little different. Some weeks you come to these blesseds and they're good and they're happy. And some weeks you get all the feels. This is an all the feel week because this week is blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. And right off the bat, we have this really interesting tension. Blessed are those who mourn. Happy are those who are sad. And when we talk about blessed, just to recap and rephrase a bit, that word blessed, it means more than being just happy, and it's more than just physical, and it's more than just the future. Because sometimes when we look at these, we paint them in those categories. When he says blessed, it's more than just you'll be happy if, because happiness fades away when your surroundings change. And that's not what Jesus is saying. He's saying like this never-ending joy happens, blessed. It's bigger, stronger, richer, deeper than just happy are you who. And then he said, blessed, it's more than just physical blessings. It's more than just you get stuff because there's a spiritual component. Because God is a God of physical and spiritual and he blesses us in both those ways. So it's not just the physical world that we see. And finally, it's not just all about one day when God saves in heaven. Sometimes we teach it that way. But Jesus came and established family rhythms that start now, that change our world now, that ultimately one day culminate in when he comes back. So when we say blessed, it's this self-satisfying joy. We defined it last week as to be blessed is to find fulfillment in aligning your principles, your practices with God's principles. So the more we live out the rhythms of God, the more blessed we are. It's a beautiful picture of what his family looks like. And then we get to the next words. It says, blessed, happy are those, but not just subjectively happy, but joyful are those who are sad. And that's a weird tension because that's not a tension I like. My daughter, I think 2 weeks ago, maybe last week, it all blends together, right? couple weeks ago, she was crying, and you know, I like to be a tough dad. I don't want to be that dad that gives into the whims of all of the little like whimpers of the kid, even though you want to. I want to be the dad that looks at me and is like, no, I let her cry. You know, I mean, I'm fine. I'm not wrapped around her finger, my finger, whatever that phrase goes, all the time, right? So I pick up my daughter because she was crying, and I let her go for like 3 seconds, and it felt like an eternity. And I picked her up, and she had like one tear falling down her face. It's the first time I'd seen a tear, right? Oh my. At that point, I didn't look at her and say, blessed are you because you're sad, right? Who does that? But the scriptures start when Jesus is saying, this is my family. Happy are you that are sad. Blessed are you that feel mourning. Blessed are you that aren't smiley, happy people all the time, like sometimes we try and pretend to be when we show up for church on Sunday mornings. Blessed are you who mourn. And what we have to do is understand that tension. We have to understand why it's okay to not be happy, but still at the same time, be happy. Paul says it like this in 2 Corinthians 6. He says, as co-workers in the gospel, as co-workers with God, he defines us as known, yet regarded as unknown. Dying, yet we live on. Beaten, and we're not killed. Sorrowful, yet always rejoicing. Blessed are those who mourn. What we have to understand where this conversation begins is an understanding of kind of the big picture and then how the big picture affects our everyday. And when it says blessed are those who mourn, it's coupled from the last beatitude where it said blessed are those who are poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. What he's saying is blessed are you guys who know you need God, you'll get him. And then it says, so blessed are those who mourn. And what it's saying is, big picture, happy are you who understand what sin is and the consequences of it. Blessed are you who mourn your poverty in spirit. It builds off one another. That's this really weird tension of happy, sad at the same time. And I've lived it, you know? I remember I was talking to a buddy of mine a couple weeks ago, and we're getting out of September, and he made a comment that kind of I hadn't thought about before. He said, you know, we're talking about different events that define generations. And for my generation, it's 9/11. I was a senior in high school. And I remember where I was and when it happened, and what I was doing before and after that. And I remember the feeling that I hadn't felt before of the world stopping, you know. And we were talking about it because he's a teacher. And he said, you know, this is the seniors this year are the last generation, the last year of high school kids who were actually alive when 9/11 happened. And I felt old, right? And I thought, man, that's so weird to me. And that kind of made me sad a bit because I remember where I was and when I was, and I remember feeling an overwhelming sadness that came that day at that time at that place. Blessed are those who mourn. When you look around, and for me, it was a generational marker of I'm sad of the state that the world is in sometimes. What I'm saying is there's a holy sadness because we understand what sin is. We understand what poverty of spirit is. Big picture, what it's doing to our world, not in the everyday. Blessed are those who mourn. And we see it in the Old Testament. We see it with God. We see it with this idea that sin is the opposite of God's good. John 10:10 said, the thief came to steal, kill, and destroy. I've come that you may have life and have it to the full. And what we see that Jesus points out, and we see it throughout the scriptures, is this pulling tension between the things of God that is good and the things that are against God that are not good. We did a whole series on it for the last month. And we get this idea of this holy sadness. Because sometimes what we do when we talk about sin and we talk about God is we know that sin angers God, but we forget that sin makes God fundamentally sad. We went here a couple weeks ago. It's one of my favorite verses. It says in Genesis 6, 5 and 6, it's the story of God's creating. And he created and then sin entered the world and sin, like it always does, grew and eventually took over. And so God's looking down at his creation in Genesis 6, and he says this, the Lord saw that the wickedness of humankind had become great on the earth. Every inclination of the thoughts of their minds was only evil all the time. The Lord regretted that he had made humankind on the earth, and he was highly offended. So we paint God as angry towards sin, and we should, but don't let it come at the expense or the cost of remembering that sin makes God sad. That when God sees the brokenness of our world, he always remembers what it should be. that every time he sees the big picture consequences of sin affecting this place, he's not just angry, but he's saddened by it. Sometimes I forget that. Sometimes I forget that because I'm up here and I teach a message about Jesus and Christianity and what God will ultimately do one day. I think some days we forget that as a Christian community. We forget to be sad about the state of sin. And sometimes when we talk about what sin is, we come across as preachy and arrogant and like we have answers and other people don't, instead of remembering that it should break our heart. In Philippians 3, Paul talks about this. He says, "For many live, about whom I've often told you, and now with tears I tell you that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ. Their end is destruction, their God is their belly. They exult in their shame, and they think about earthly things." I think every time we talk about the sin of our world, every time we're talking about how mad it makes God, every time we're talking about people that don't know Jesus and people that do, every time it should make us sad and that should bring about compassion. Every time we should do it through tearful eyes. Because people can tell the difference when we don't. Every time we talk about the weight of sin in our world, it should come with sorrow because of what sin does to our world. Blessed are those who mourn. And when you look at it big picture, hopefully it moves us to this place of compassion that gives us a love for people and places that don't know Jesus like it did Paul, instead of pride and arrogance and anger all the time. Blessed are those who mourn. And so really, one of the first questions that pop up as we get into this text is, does sin make us sad? When you are confronted with sin, when you see it in your family, when you see it with people you don't know, what is our initial response to our condition? Last week we looked at a parable of a tax collector and a Pharisee. I'll read a bit of it again. Jesus is talking about poor in spirit, and he says in this Pharisee, two men went to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed about himself like this: "God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, extortionists, unrighteous people, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of everything I have." The tax collector, however, stood far off and would not even look up to the heaven, but he beat his breast and said, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner that I am." Poverty of spirit leads to a mourning over the sin that we have and the sin in our world. Sin makes God sad, and I hope it makes us sad too. Big picture. Because we look at the world and we look at what's happening and we realize that it's not the way it should have been. And every time we talk about it, I want to be a people that talks about it with tears in our eyes, with love and compassion, just like Paul did. It goes on from there, though, because I don't think it's good enough with this beatitude to simply say, big picture S, capital S, sin should make us sad because people go to hell one day, and say that's the whole ballgame. I think we see effects of our sin in our everyday. And so the sadness or the mourning that is there because of the effect of sin, big capital S, on the entire scope of the world is there in microcosms every day, on Mondays and Tuesdays and Wednesdays. I think the brokenness of the system as a whole impacts the small ways that we see brokenness every day. And I know that because I live in Texas in the summer, right? I do. And we just came out of it, and it's not a bad place to be, I guess. But listen to me. As I get older, it is really difficult to live in a place that when it says 107 outside and then heat index is like 119, I'm joyful about. I don't know why people came here, camped out, and said, "Let's stay." You know what I'm talking about? Before air conditioning. They were so much tougher than me, right? And here's what happens in July and August. I will be in my house, and the thermostat is set at 70 or 71. Maybe some days I'm having a bad day and I want to kind of give a whole, like, you know, sarcastic look to the weather, and I'll turn down to 68 and put a sweater on in July, you know, just because I can, right? Because I like to control things. And then you go outside, and the sun is doing what the sun does. And you open the door and you get hit, smacked in the face with the gates of hell. You know what I'm talking about, right? And then you walk to your car. Like, that's not bad enough. You walk to your car and you open the door and you know I'm walking into a sauna right now. Into a sauna. And I'm going to go to work and I'm going to be sweating. I have to explain that away like it's not a problem that I have. It's Texas in the summer, you know? And you sit down in your sauna that is a car with black leather seats like mine, and part of your thigh grazes the black leather seat, and you have third-degree burns for the rest of your life. And then you touch this steering wheel, and it scorches your hands, and you can't let go because they're melting to the wheel itself. And you think, I know how to fix this, air conditioning. And you turn on your air conditioning in your car, and it blows the sun's air back on your face. You know? Some of you people have self-starting cars, and you do that in advance. I don't like any of you, okay? My point is simply, the pain of seeing and feeling and experiencing the heat in the Texas summer of all those different ways along just reflect how broken the system was in the first place, and it makes us sad. So when we talk about blessed are those who mourn, we have to move past a meta-narrative and get into, it also makes God mourn today. It also makes God mourn with us as we experience the effects of that sadness or sin. One of my favorite places to look at it is a story in John chapter 11. In John 11, you probably know the story. It's pretty popular and we go to it a lot here. Jesus had just lost one of his best friends, a man named Lazarus, and his two sisters were there. And in John chapter 11, he knew that Lazarus had died, and so he goes to be with the family. And I'm just going to read verses 32 to 35. It says, now when Mary came to the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said to him, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping and the people who had come with her weeping, he was intensely moved in spirit and greatly distressed. He asked, where have you laid him? They replied, Lord, come and see. Verse 35, so Jesus wept. What we see, and why I love this text, is it reminds me that Jesus mourns with us when we feel the effects of our sin. Jesus was going to raise this guy from the dead, spoiler alert, a couple verses later. And he knew that because God's omniscient. He knew what he was going to do. He knew why he went there in the first place. So the question remains, why did he weep with them in the moment? Simply because I think God looked around and saw the effects and the consequences of sin on his friends and his family, and he was deeply saddened by it. So what we see is a picture of a God who mourns with us as we feel the effects of our poverty in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Not just big picture, but right here and right now. And so the state of our sin shouldn't just, as people that live out the family rhythms of God, make us sad big picture, but it should make us sad every day. That's a tough statement sometimes because we're a grace-based church, you know? We believe that God's grace covers. We believe that you are not defined by what you've done, but by what Jesus did. And so we teach a message of grace. We do not teach shame. We say shame only is good if it points you to how God has set you free. And we teach an identity in Jesus. And I don't believe shame-based modification for behavior does anything. I don't believe if I got up here and shamed you about how you're not sad enough about sin, that you're ultimately going to be more sad about sin and move on with life. I think we talk about it because it points back to who God is and what he's done for us. The grace of God is good. And so we live into the rhythms of God, not to earn God's appeal or be better at this. We live into the rhythms of God because we understand the depth of the grace of God. And if we have to understand the depth of the grace of God, we have to talk about the weight of sin. We have to. Because if we don't talk about the weight of sin, then what we do is we make grace cheap. Because it's free for you, but it wasn't free for God. You know? So my kid, I had this idea this morning. And I think I'm going to do it. I think it's a brilliant parenting move. I went to a one-year-old birthday party yesterday, and I leaned over to my wife, and I said, we're not going to do this, right? And she said, yes, we are. And I said, okay. I'm growing. I just said, sure, you know? It's great. It's beautiful. It's funny. So we went to this birthday party, and I thought to myself, you know what? And I've thought this oftentimes because I worked in youth ministry for a long time and I saw high school kids pretend like they didn't need their parents anymore. And I have a kid that's, you know, 5 weeks old. And one day if she ever decides to do that to me, I am going to start doing this. I'm going to, every year of her life, chronicle how many hours of sleep I've lost because I sustained her life. I'm going to write it down in a book. And then every birthday, starting with the first one, I'm going to say, this year is this many hours of sleep. This is what you cost me. I'd do it again. You are worth it. You don't have to do anything for it. I just need you to know my love wasn't free for you all the time. All right? If we don't talk about the weight of sin, we forget that grace costs somebody something. We take it for granted. Blessed are those who mourn, who understands that grace isn't free. And so when we talk about the mourning of the everyday, We have to say that we can't take sin lightly, you know? And it's a hard thing to do because we believe in grace. It's kind of like, well, James 1, let's go there. James 1 talks about sin like this. It says, but each one is tempted when he's lured and enticed by his own desires. Then when desire conceives, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is full grown, it gives birth to death. Why do we not take sin lightly? It's because we understand what it is and what it does. And every single time from Genesis 1 to Genesis 6, from Genesis 6 to now, what sin does is it starts small, like it's no big deal. It grows and it kills every single time. One of my favorite analogies for this verse in James is to talk about pets, you know? And there are so many you can go from, but last night I did a Google search looking for a specific example of pets that have killed their owners. That was a fun hour of reading for me, right? And mostly what that means is I'm not talking about puppies and kittens and all that stuff. They're great. I'm talking sometimes people think it's a good idea to take in as pets exotic wild animals that kill things in their nature. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my, right? So I found a story of a guy in South Africa. His name was Marius Els in 2011. And he adopted a 5-month-old hippo. Right? He adopted a 5-month-old hippo. He named it Humphrey the Hippo. It was adorable. I watched video of this guy swimming with this hippo, and he got interviewed, and he said, it's like a son to me. This is not a pet. This is family. I know this hippo. So this hippo grew. I don't know if you guys are aware of hippos. You know, we play that game as kids where we slap them on the butt, and they eat these little marbles, and so we teach kids that hippos are cute. Hippos kill more people in Africa than all the other animals combined, pretty much. I don't know if you knew that. They are incredibly dangerous and huge. Humphrey the hippo grew from 5 months to 1.2 tons, right? And then it killed his owner. It got so big, and one day, you know, his owner was a grown man. It bit him and killed him. Because hippos are naturally aggressive. They're wired to kill. I'm not saying anything good, bad, or indifferent. I'm simply saying they're not good pets. And what do I mean by that is sometimes we look at 5-month-old hippos and say, I can control this or contain this or it's not that bad, knowing full well what happens when they grow up, and we convince ourselves that it's not a big deal. Sin is often like that. We have smaller sins or littler sins that we don't talk about as much, like gossip or slander. We do little white lies and we don't realize that those little things oftentimes, like sin always does, grows and leads to death and it kills. So what this text is telling us is be sad over the little sins too. Understand the weight of sin, how that impacts your idea of grace. And I pray and I hope, and this is something I need to hear in my life because I believe in grace. I need to look at my life and say, where is sin? I want to mourn over it because I know where it leads. Blessed are those who mourn. It's this picture, big and small, one day off and now, that we mourn the effects of sin on our world and on our lives. And so when we talk about rules, and when we talk about why we live certain ways, and when we talk about the don't do lists in scripture, it has literally nothing to do with rules. It has everything to do with, I want to point you towards life because I know where sin goes, and it goes towards death. I was talking with a friend of mine yesterday. I had a tough conversation with some of his friends about some decisions they were making, and he's in an authority position. And he said, man, they're breaking some of our rules. It's a Christian organization that we signed up for, and they're in some sin in a couple ways, and I need some wisdom on how to do it. And I said, don't say the word rules. Say, we believe we live a certain way because it leads towards life. It's not about rules and not rules. It's about life and death, because that's what sin is. And so when I talk to my wife, or when my wife talks to me, or when my friends talk to me and see certain things in me that are sin, it's not a matter of you're breaking God's rules. It's you're walking closer to death than you need to walk towards life. Blessed are those who mourn. And what I love about God, what I need to know about God, and this text does a good job of, I need to know that initially God cares for us. I need to know that God, in his goodness, doesn't just see us crying there and say, man, that sucks for you. I need to know that God not only mourns with us, but that he can do something about it. You know, it's like if my kid is sitting there crying with little tears, I can feel as badly as I want to, but if I let her just lay there and keep crying, that's not very loving. So it doesn't say, blessed are those who mourn. One day it's going to get better. It says, blessed are those who mourn, and this is my favorite part, for they will be comforted. So we get to the second half of our beatitude. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. And just like mourning, how it had a big picture application to the weight and consequences of sin for our world and ultimately our eternal fate, it also affected our day-to-day. Comfort is the same way. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. So big picture, God comforts. Big picture, God comforts in a few different ways. One of the biggest ones is 2 Corinthians 5. God made the one who didn't know sin to be sin for us so that we might become the righteousness of God. You know how God comforts? He forgives sin. God comforts by saying, you're no longer defined by the worst decisions you've made. God comforts by saying that sin that you mourn over isn't something that's going to shape and mold you forever. God comforts by saying, I see you through the lens of my son who's perfect, not through the lens of the deplorable and depraved things that define the world around you that make you sad. God comforts because he forgives us. And I don't know if you guys are wired this way. I definitely am. It's really, really hard for me to believe in forgiveness, and it's much easier for me to believe that I'm not good enough. I struggle with that. I struggle with looking back at my life and saying I've disappointed these people this many times, all the time. I struggle with understanding and holding on to the fact that I have been forgiven. I struggle with making that my identity. And what God says in the middle of us understanding and weeping over our sin is, I've comforted you. You want to know how I've done that? It doesn't define you anymore. He says, forgive yourselves, I've already forgiven you. And that's a hard place to be and a really difficult thing to do. And I need to keep people around me that remind me of this family rhythm, because I will and do often forget. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. So he forgives that thing that did define us, that causes us to mourn in the first place. It's a beautiful comfort. Two, it's also painting a picture of a day when sin no longer defines us as a people, as a place, as a space. We talk about it, we call it heaven, right? This place where one day there will be no more sin. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be, it's future tense, comforted. Talking to when God rights all wrongs, it's the last series we did. You see it most clearly in Isaiah 61. Jesus came on the scene and he goes to the temple and he starts teaching. And it's from this passage, he said, this is what I came to do. And so let me read a little bit of it. Isaiah 61, verse 1, I'm going to skip down to verse 3. He says this, the Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me because the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and to release darkness, and to release from darkness for the prisoners, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. He also goes down to say, to bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of joy instead of mourning, and a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. Ultimately, what God does is say, I will end sin. And that is comforting if we weep over it. To know that it won't define our world forever. To know that he doesn't just sit there and let us cry tear after tear after tear, but he picks us up and says, I'm making it better. It's also why we can get together on Mother's Day and celebrate Ronnie with some twinge of hopefulness. Because as Christians, we believe that this is not the end. There's a hope of eternality. There's a hope that God's righting all wrongs. There's a hope that if you know and follow Jesus, we will once again celebrate the life as it was intended to be lived in the first place. There is a hope that comes with death. It's this weird tension of, I am sad, but I am happy. So death, which is intrinsically sad, becomes somewhat hopeful because God transforms it. It's comfort. It's a beautiful comfort we cling to. And so even though we remember, we look forward. So God says, blessed are those who mourn, for you will be comforted. Look forward. I'm doing something, and I will ultimately do the thing one day that ends the bad thing. But again, just like we talked about when we talked about mourning, I don't think it's simply a comfort that only happens one time in the future. I think we see comfort here and now as God steps into our midst. So if you go back to John chapter 11, what I love about that text, I don't know if you guys play this game. I do often and I talk about it. I play this game, what if I was God? What would I do? You know, if I was God and I got to describe or define or kind of set up the pieces in this game of life, how would I do things? I do this all the time when I read the scriptures, right? And when you read through John chapter 11, one of the things that always gets me, one of the things that I think about is, why did Jesus walk to the city with the people? Because make no mistake about it, Jesus said in Matthew 4, right before this, that I've come to kick off my kingdom. It happens now. I'm going to do it through healing people. I'm going to meet felt need where I can because there is felt need, right? That's part of what comfort is, and that's part of what Jesus did. That's part of why, as a church, we have Local Mission Sunday, where we have 9 tables out there, because there are people tonight that are hungry and don't have homes. There are teenagers tonight that need your help, and we say as a church, go sign up and comfort people that feel right now, right here, the effects of sin in their life. Do it. That's what it means to serve Jesus in love. And so Jesus came to do that, absolutely. But I play the game, if I was God, why would I just do that and be done with it? Why would he draw it out over time? So Jesus has healed people before in the New Testament. He's risen people from the dead. There was one story where a Roman centurion came to him and said, my daughter's sick. And he said, okay, take me to her. And the centurion said, you're God. You don't have to go anywhere. You can just fix this right now. And Jesus says, that's right. And he does, right? So my question is, if Jesus knew he was going to heal Lazarus, why go there? Why weep with those people? Why not just say 2 days before that, when they said, Lazarus is sick, I'm going to fix it. It's going to be okay. Why do that? And I think it's simply because we forget sometimes that the most comforting thing we can do is step into the pain of others and be present. Because that's what Jesus did for us. He shows up to these people and he weeps with them. For 30 years before he started his ministry, he was a son and a friend and a brother. Why? Why? Why didn't Jesus just snap his fingers and fix the whole thing? I think it points to this really powerful ministry of presence that is comforting in the middle of pain. You know? I look at the scriptures, and when it says things like from the very beginning in John 1, when it says, and the word became flesh and it dwelt among us, I can't help be reminded about the beauty of being present in the pain of others. And here's why that's really difficult, because I'm not wired that way. I'm a fixer. I want to fix problems. You know why? Because I don't like pain. Who does? When my daughter cries, I want to stop it right now. You know how frustrating it is to have your daughter cry and not be able to fix the problem? Just have her wail. And you're like, I'm so sorry. I'm really trying. I can't do anything. And everything I'm trying to do makes it worse. I think we, as Westerners, I think we as people in Flower Mound, Texas, are wired to fix problems, but I think oftentimes we miss the big picture that maybe the comfort God's calling us to bring is presence in the middle of pain of problems that we can't fix because we're not big enough, you know? So what do you do when you see the effects of sin in our world and somebody's kid is sick or loses a job or find somebody has cancer, or somebody dies? There's big problems that we've all been through that I can't fix. What do? I sit with them. I sit with them in the middle of their pain, and I'm reminded that that's what Jesus did for me. Just like Jesus, I think God calls us to be present in the pain of others. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. I want to be a church that's present in our community. You know, and we forget that. We forget that because we want to fix so easily and so quickly. And that's good because it's a recognition something's not right. But there's power in presence. It's what Jesus did for us, does with us right here, right now. And we can't forget that. The best example I have of this in my life is when I was 19 or 20. I moved to Guatemala and I taught at a school there. I knew I was about a 2-year-old in my conversational Spanish. So I knew colors and days of the week, and I could say repeat, and that's how I taught, you know. Small private school in the mountain country of Guatemala, and all day long what I did was I taught for half the day, and then when I wasn't teaching, I was like running around playing soccer with these kids. There's a couple hundred of them. I loved it. That was back when I had energy, when I was young. And one day, I get a phone call, and this was, again, mountain country in Guatemala 15 years ago, so they didn't have internet everywhere. Rarely did people have cell phones, so I didn't talk to people from here. I didn't talk to family. I'm not great at keeping up with people anyway. I'm just bad at that kind of managing of tasks. The menial day-to-day stuff is not, I forget. And so I got a call one day. I'd been there for about 2 months. I got a call from my sister one day. We don't talk much anyway. Love my sister, but again, we're just not those kind of people. And so I said, oh, this is something. So I go into the office and I get there and I pick up the phone. It was Heather and she said, "Hey, Charlie." And I said, "Hey, what are you calling for?" And then the phone died. And I sat there for what seemed like 30 minutes. So it was probably like a minute and a half. And she called back and it went through and she said, "Hey, your grandmother died." And I was close with my grandmother, real close. And so that took me from the happy-go-lucky, life is great, let's play soccer, and yell the four Spanish words I know at you, to just a state of sadness, mourning. And so I went up these little concrete bleachers, and I sat there. And I just sat there. And I mean, I don't know if you guys know this, I'm a pretty loud guy, so I wasn't being loud. And people were like, "Oh, what's wrong with the white guy?" And as I was sitting there, these three sixth grade girls walk up to me and they said, "Hey, what's wrong?" And I said, again in my broken Spanish, "Grandma, dead." And they said, "Oh." And look, we could have talked if they wanted to because I would not have understood them. And for 30 minutes, they just sat there with me. They just sat there. And they cried with me a little bit and we just sat there. I remember going from feeling so lonely because I was a few thousand miles away from anybody that knew my grandmother or any of my family members to feeling more comforted than I've ever felt in my life. It's the power of presence. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. What are those people and places? What does comfort look like? Sometimes we can fix things and comfort people, and sometimes it's just stepping into the pain of others. It's hard because it makes us uncomfortable, but it's beautiful and it's powerful, and it's what Jesus did. There's an author I like, his name's Henry Nouwen. He talks about the ministry of presence often. He has a quote, it's long, and you'll see the end of it on your screen in a sec, but I'm going to read the whole thing. He says, "More and more, the desire grows in me to simply walk around, to greet people, to enter their homes, to sit on their doorsteps, play ball, throw water, and be known as someone who wants to live with them. It's a privilege to have the time to practice this simple ministry of presence. Still, it's not as simple as it seems. My own desire is to be useful, to do something significant, or to be part of some impressive project. It's so strong that it takes up all my time, and they're taken up by meetings and conferences, study groups and workshops that prevent me from walking the streets. It's difficult not to have plans, not to organize people around an urgent cause, not to feel that you're working directly for social progress. But I wonder more and more if the first thing shouldn't be to know people by name, to eat and drink with them, to listen to their stories and to tell your own, and to let them know with words, handshakes, and hugs that you do not simply like them, but you truly love them. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." It's a promise and it's a charge to the Church of Jesus Christ. It's a promise and it's a charge to us to be present in our communities, to plug in and fix things where we can fix them, and to pay for people's laundries and to make meals for people and to meet needs, but also to show up in the places where I can't fix the problems. Because when we do that, we paint a picture of a family rhythm that's different than the one that's painted outside of Jesus. And we say there is hope. And one day it's going to come in full, but right now it looks like us just sitting here together, and this is what Jesus does for you too. Because when you feel hopeless in the middle of the effects of our sin, or maybe just our sin, I'm reminded that God knows, that God is near, and that God comforts with his presence. That's a reminder I need often because I like to fix things. It's what Paul means, to go back to it in 2 Corinthians when he says, "Sorrowful yet always rejoicing." It's this beautiful picture that we're happy and we're sad at the same time. That we're sorrowful but we're joyful. That we're sad but we're hopeful. Because he's painting a different picture of a different family, and his rhythm is, yeah, it's okay to be sad. It's okay. But don't end there. Know that our God is a God who comforts. And as we show up, and as we're present with the people around us, we show other people the family rhythms of God. Let me pray for us. God, I'm thankful that you're here. I'm thankful that you give comfort in the middle of the effects of my sin. I'm thankful that I'm forgiven. I'm thankful that I'm not the things that I've done in the past, that Jesus says we are something different. I'm thankful that you comfort us. My prayer today is two things. One, that we understand the weight of sin, that we take it seriously, not to feel badly about ourselves, but to understand the massive beauty of grace. And that as we do that, we are comforted once again because you are here and you know us. So as we worship one more time this morning, I pray that we are comforted by your Spirit. I pray that we know you are good and that you are here and that you bring hope where there is mourning. We pray these things in the name of Jesus. Amen.